To them, you're reading articles from the Harvard Health Letter and from the Harvard Women's Health Letter. And the first article is going to be, Start Vetting Your Supplements. Use these strategies and tools to uncover risks lurking in seemingly harmless supplements. There are plenty of good reasons to take a dietary supplement. Maybe you're deficient in a particular vitamin or mineral, such as vitamin D or iron. Or you have a poor diet and your doctor recommends a multivitamin. Or perhaps there aren't many ways to treat a health problem you have, such as osteoarthritis, and your doctor says it won't hurt to try a certain supplement that has a small chance of easing symptoms. So there you are, standing the supplement aisle of a drugstore, savvy enough to be wary of dietary supplements, yet wondering how to recognize the bad ones. Fortunately, certain strategies and online tools can help. Be cautious about quality. The supplement industry is notorious for producing products that don't contain what they claim. The FDA leaves it up to companies to ensure the purity and safety of their products, but there is not much incentive. It rarely penalizes manufacturers for not having the right amount of ingredients in a product, says Dr. Pieter Cohen, an associate professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School who studies supplements. For example, recent research by Dr. Cohen and his colleagues found that 25 brands of gummies with melatonin contain dangerously high levels, up to 347% more melatonin than what was listed on labels. Some of the brands they tested also contain the marijuana derivative cannabinol, better known as CBD, also at levels that exceeded label claims. Look for supplements with certification seals from vetted independent third parties. Most seals of approval are meaningless, but the U.S. Department of Defense has identified several certifying organizations that do a good job ensuring supplements are labeled accurately, Dr. Cohen says. DOD-approved certifying organizations include the U.S. Pharmacopeia and NSF International Certified for Sports Program. Both test many types of supplements. The FDA is seeing an increase in supplements that contain hidden prescription drugs, controlled substances, or untested and unstudied components. If you use these products, there's a risk that they might cause serious side effects or interact with medications you're taking. The tainted supplements are widely available and sold online from sellers on eBay or Amazon, and even through large retail stores. Look up ingredients you don't recognize on FDA websites that can help you identify potentially dangerous products or supplement ingredients. One useful reference is the Dietary Supplement Ingredient Directory, which is available at www.health.harvard.edu/DSID, unveiled in March 2023. It enables you to quickly look up dozens of different ingredients and get basic information, as well as links to research and warnings about them. The other is the Health Fraud Database, which lists some but not all products that have been subject to FDA-related violations. The DOD has a resource anyone can use to check and see if a supplement seems safe. It's called the Operation Supplement Safety Scorecard. The scorecard provides a checklist of 7 questions you can answer quickly to determine if a supplement seems safe. Is there an approved third-party certification seal on the product label? Is the label free of claims or statements that seem questionable? Are there fewer than 6 ingredients? If you don't get at least 4 yes answers to the questions on the scorecard, the supplement is too risky to take. Do a little detective work if your clinician suggests that you take a supplement, especially a botanical treatment. Be skeptical, Dr. Cohen says. Ask if there's a study about it, but it needs to be a large randomized control trial to be credible. You can also look up medical studies on your own by going to a reliable search engine called PubMed from the National Institutes of Health. NIH also provides fact sheets on a wide variety of dietary supplements. Check them out at www.health.harvard.edu/DSFS and see if there's a good reason to take the supplement you're considering. If not, it's probably safer to skip the risk. Now, here's a very practical article that's entitled Tips for Getting Used to Over-the-Counter Hearing Aids. Be patient during the first 2 weeks and learn tricks to adjust the device in challenging environments. Hearing aids are more accessible and affordable than ever thanks to a new category of FDA-approved devices. If you or your family members think you have mild to moderate hearing loss, you can buy over-the-counter hearing aids without seeing a doctor, going through hearing tests, or getting a prescription. Scoring a pair of OTC devices is just the first step. It takes time to learn how to use, wear, and adjust them. There's two types. One comes with a few predetermined settings. The other is called self-fitting, enables you to customize settings based on a hearing test you take on an app or a manufacturer's website. Both types have volume controls and both allow you to toggle between settings. The first 2 weeks you wear hearing aids can be a little bumpy. Your voice may sound different to you, like it has a different volume or quality. And soft sounds like running water or shoes brushing along a carpet may sound louder than normal and even a little irritating. The brain has to adjust. It's like being in a dark room and turning on the light. The room seems too bright until your eyes get used to it, says Sarah Hesseltine, an audiologist at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts Eye and Ear. To cope during the adjustment period, Hesseltine recommends wearing the hearing aids at home, where there's a lot of soft sounds, for at least a few hours per day, and longer if possible. Try not to fiddle with the volume too much. Hesseltine suggests allowing soft sounds to be louder than normal so the brain will get used to it. Once soft sounds don't seem as loud, try wearing the hearing aids in other environments, like the grocery store, the car, or a noisy restaurant. Unlike many prescription hearing aids that adjust the volume automatically when there's a significant change in noise around you, OTC hearing aids must be adjusted manually. For example, you might need one setting for watching TV, another for doing yard work, and one for being in a noisy environment like a restaurant. Some situations can be particularly difficult for hearing aid use. One is at a restaurant or party. Because of background noise, you probably won't get 100% clarity understanding speech. Even prescription hearing aids have this limitation. The trick is setting the hearing aid to pick up sounds in front of you, and then putting the background noise behind you. Don't sit with the wall behind you at a restaurant. Sit with the loud tables behind you. Another option for a conversation at a restaurant is having the person you're chatting with use a remote microphone. It can be placed on the table or worn on the person's lapel. The microphone will send the sound directly to your hearing aid. Wind blowing over the hearing aid microphones creates excessive noise. Hesseltine suggests wearing a hood or hat to help block the wind and reduce noise. Many hearing aids have a microphone that's worn over the ear, which is easy to forget when you're on a phone call. If you can't hear someone, try shifting the phone higher toward the hearing aid microphone. If doing that creates loud feedback like whistling or squealing, that means the earpiece doesn't fit well and isn't all the way in the ear. Try putting a different size tip on the part of the hearing aid that goes in your ear. It may take a little trial and error to learn what works best for you, so brace yourself for a learning curve. The article goes on to say that there's times when you should take out your hearing aid. Hearing aids are vulnerable and can be easily damaged by heat or moisture, and easily lost if they fall out of your ears while you sleep. Always take out the device when you go to bed, shower, swim, blow dry your hair, or go to a salon. And if your hearing aids get wet from perspiration during exercise, give them a break from moisture and let them dry out. Now here's an article from Ask the Doctor, Dr. Anthony L. Komaroff, Editor-in-Chief. And the article answers the question, vaccines are successful in preventing infectious diseases. Is it possible that scientists could make a vaccine to prevent Alzheimer's disease? Although vaccines have been used primarily to prevent infectious disease, they're starting to be tried for non-infectious disease, including several types of cancer. That research is in its early stages. Is it unreasonable to think about vaccines for Alzheimer's disease? I don't think so. How might they work? Vaccines prevent a particular infection, like the flu, and typically introduce a tiny piece of the flu virus into the body. The immune system sees that little piece, recognizes that it's foreign, and starts to make cells that can recognize and kill the actual flu virus if it should enter the body. In Alzheimer's, certain molecules are increased in the brain and can damage brain cells, amyloid beta and tau. There are currently 9 trials of vaccines for Alzheimer's underway. All of them are in people with mild Alzheimer's or with the pre-Alzheimer's condition called mild cognitive impairment. The vaccines are all designed to encourage the immune system to remove amyloid beta or tau deposits from the brain. Most are given by injection. One being tested at Harvard Medical School uses a nasal spray. It'll be several years before we know if they will work. One reason these particular trials may not work is that the buildup of amyloid beta and tau seen in Alzheimer's typically begins many decades before a person has any symptoms. Fortunately, new tests are helping to identify younger adults in whom the buildup is starting. Vaccines given to these younger people theoretically could be more effective than vaccines given to people decades older who already have symptoms. Finally, there is an entirely different way in which vaccines could work in preventing Alzheimer's. What causes the buildup of amyloid beta and tau seen in people with the disease? Increasingly, studies find that the infections of the brain at relatively young ages, particularly infections that linger for decades at low levels, may cause people to make more amyloid beta year after year, raising the risk of Alzheimer's. Vaccines targeting those infections could theoretically also reduce the risk of the condition. Treatments that quiet the inflammation caused by chronic low-grade infection of the brain without directly targeting the infection itself is also being contemplated. Please understand, all of this is theoretical and unproven. Even if vaccines work, we won't know that for a long time. Since Alzheimer's takes decades to develop, it will take decades to determine if a vaccine given to younger adults works. But with a disease as terrible as Alzheimer's, you've got to keep trying. Now again in the Harvard Health Letter, this is the July 2023 issue, there's a useful article entitled, Time for a New Knee? Ask these questions first. When a worn knee starts to give you trouble, non-surgical treatments are the first line of defense. Weight loss, physical therapy, or injections may help reduce your pain. If your knee doesn't respond to those approaches, it's time to consider a joint replacement. And you'll need information to make a decision about the surgery, which is a big commitment. Here are some questions to ask and a sneak peek at what your doctor might say, courtesy of Dr. Estonia Chen, an orthopedic surgeon and director of research for the Division of Adult Reconstruction and Total Joint Arthroplasty at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. What should I look for in a knee replacement surgeon? Ideally, your surgeon would be someone who is board certified in orthopedic surgery, fellowship trained, and a specialist in knee replacement. But that type of expert might not be available in your community. If not, look for an orthopedic surgeon who's been performing knee replacements for at least 2 years, and make sure the surgeon you choose performs at least 2 knee replacements a month. What type of prosthetic is best? The gold standard knee replacement is made of cobalt chromium with polyethylene in between the metal pieces. Sometimes the bone behind the kneecap will be replaced with polyethylene. There are additional materials like titanium or zirconium that can be used in knee replacements. The best prosthetic will be the one your surgeon is comfortable implanting, unless you have a metal allergy, which you should discuss with your doctor. How should I prepare physically for a knee replacement? Pre-surgery physical ability predicts your post-surgery physical ability. Work on bending, straightening, and strengthening the knee as much as possible. Physical therapy can help, and so can exercises you can do at home. How should I prepare my home for my recovery? Remove anything that might cause you to slip and fall, like throw rugs, floor clutter, and furniture that blocks your path. It will help to have certain types of equipment at home, including a walker and a cane. You can also consider getting a raised toilet seat and a bedside commode, but not every patient will need those. Which surgical approach will you take? There are 3 main approaches. One goes around the kneecap, one goes through the middle of the quadricep muscle, and one goes underneath the quads. There are pluses and minuses for each one, and it mostly depends on the approach your surgeon is most experienced with. Will you use robotic tools? Some studies have shown that robotic surgery is more precise. I personally use robotic tools, says Dr. Chen, but robotics are not available at every hospital. What are potential surgery complications and what will you do to reduce them? Knee replacement risks include bleeding, blood clots, and infection. We use devices to stop bleeding at the time of surgery, and we may apply a tourniquet. You'll likely get an antibiotic before surgery to prevent infection and a blood thinner after surgery to prevent clots. Will I have to stay overnight in the hospital? Most people go home, says Dr. Chen, on the day of their surgery or stay overnight in the hospital for one night. Home health services can provide visiting nurses or physical therapists who go to a patient's home after surgery. How much pain will I have, and how will you treat it? The first 2 to 6 weeks after surgery will be very painful, and we have an extensive plan to treat it. We start right before surgery giving the patient painkillers like Tylenol and Celebrex, as well as spinal anesthesia. During surgery, Dr. Chen says that she will inject a number of different analgesics and anti-inflammatory medicines into the knee. After surgery, we use narcotics like oxycodone only sparingly. If necessary, we can prescribe low-level narcotics like tramadol, but we prefer that you use acetaminophen around the clock. It may not work well on its own, but adding a nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drug like naproxen or a nerve medication like Neurontin can improve pain relief. Dr. Chen says that stiffness and swelling can happen right after knee surgery. It's important to get right into physical rehabilitation to prevent stiffness. What will the rehabilitation look like? If you are deconditioned or undergo surgery in both knees at the same time, you might need to go to an in-house rehab facility after surgery for a week or two. If you're stronger, you can go home and have a physical therapist visit you at home, or go to an outpatient facility for physical therapy. The rehab process can last up to 3 months, and it's a year until you are fully recovered. When will I be active again? You might have to walk with a walker or crutches for 1 to 2 weeks, and then walk with a cane or one crutch for another 2 to 4 weeks. It can take 3 to 6 months to get you back to brisk walking, 6 to 9 months for activities like tennis or golf, and 9 months to 1 year for skiing. How long will the prosthetic last? The plastic part of the prosthetic knee will wear out in about 15 to 20 years, and you might need surgery to replace it. Now I'm going to go on to another subject. This comes from the Harvard Women's Health Watch, again, the July issue. And this article is entitled Menopause Marketing, Hype versus Truth. Some skincare products claim to meet women's specific midlife needs, but is it just smoke and mirrors? Nestled just inches apart in the cosmetic section of the big box retailer are two little pots of night cream, both made by the same manufacturer. One label is magenta, the other is teal. Wake up to skin that looks refreshed and less tired, says the magenta version, called Menopause Skin Care. Meanwhile, the teal-clad Advanced Overnight Night Cream pledges that fine lines and wrinkles will appear visibly reduced. A closer look reveals both night creams contain nearly identical active ingredients, but the menopause edition costs $5 more, 25% more than the standard anti-aging version. So what's the real difference? Aside from labeling and price, not much. Meaning skincare brands may be quietly fleecing women at a vulnerable point, when worries over changing looks and vitality merge with hot flashes and hide-and-seek periods. If you're taking virtually the same product, changing the label's colors and wording to make it more appealing to midlife women, and selling it at a higher price is predatory, says Dr. Ian Schifrin, director of the Midlife Women's Health Center at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts General Hospital. A brand could just be putting a menopause label on a product when a lot of these products contain the same tried-and-true ingredients that are anti-aging for everyone, says Dr. Ariane Shady Kourouche, a dermatologist at Massachusetts General. There could be hype in the labeling. It's no mystery why a plethora of menopause skincare products have popped up on store shelves in recent years. The trend coincides with a wave of aging women who may feel flush with extra cash as they burn their mortgages and finish paying children's college tuition. Nearly 63 million American women were 50 or older in 2021, 20% of the U.S. population. And older adults are projected to outnumber children for the first time in U.S. history in 2034, according to the U.S. Census Bureau. So while anti-aging lotions and potions have been marketed for decades, the $49 billion beauty industry now sees dollar signs in midlife women at the height of their earning and buying potential, Dr. Schifrin says. Women over 50 boast a combined spending power of $15 $1 trillion and control 95% of household purchasing decisions, says the AARP. We're living longer. We're aging better, we're healthier, and we're wealthier, Dr. Shiffrin says. Everyone has realized midlife women are a large group of consumers with money to spare, and it's caught the attention of these product makers. But midlife women need to know they're a target now, she adds. We have to stay in a state of buyer beware, or companies will try to take advantage of us. Staying ahead of potentially deceptive skincare marketing first requires understanding what happens to women's skin as we age. As the largest organ, the skin joins virtually every other body part in chronicling the effects of falling estrogen level as menopause approaches. Estrogen fuels the production of oil and other substances that moisturize and protect the skin. When levels drop, skin can't hold moisture as effectively, leading to dryness, dullness, and irritation. Estrogen decline also coincides with a diminishing production of collagen, a type of protein that makes the skin firmer. Beyond that, many women in perimenopause and beyond develop new or worsening cases of rosacea, a chronic inflammatory skin condition marked by redness and rashes that usually arises on the nose and cheeks. Well, I'm going to continue with that article in the Harvard Women's Health Letter next time, because it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. I sure hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Thank you.